very important thing to consider. So when you consider, so this is thermal field theory, simple example of thermal field theory in plastics. Okay? Okay, well, when you have a static situation, then you have a potential invariant, and you can define a Hamiltonian, it's natural to consider a thermal equilibrium state, the density matrix, which just corresponds with a proper normalization to this network and state of the Hamiltonian for that system. In particular, if you consider theory with interaction, the whole theory would correspond to having the Hamiltonian here, not only for the free fields, but also for the interaction. The full Hamiltonian effect. Okay, and now this can be formulated in terms of path integrals and in terms of a Euclidean path integral, so in that way you can get the density matrix for this state in Schrödinger picture, and it's again proportional to the normalization factor to this Euclidean path integral that takes you from this phi to phi. And this is a functional integral with a Euclidean action. Again, this is for the full theory. For the full theory, including interactions. And, okay, and this Euclidean action is the usual one which is integrated from 0 to beta. So this is the value of the field 0, and this is the function. That's the Euclidean action, that integral thing. All the integrals appearing in the action and in the curve. I'll say that in a moment. So all the integrals that appear in the action, the time integrals run from 0 to beta. Okay, there are a couple of ways of thinking of, in which one usually studies thermal field theory. One is the imaginary time formalism. And what that corresponds to, well, let me say, so that we define some generating functional for the correlation functions in this case, it would correspond to this. And you see this, the notation that I'm using now is a bit more general because I'll be generalizing that in a moment. Okay. Right, so it's a little bit similar. So you have the exponential, and then this would be the part that would give you the generating functional. This integral here is again some integral in time and in space, and the time part is along this contour that I'm about to describe for you in a moment. And similarly, the integrals that appear in the action here for the interacting theory are also taken along those that contour. So in the imaginary time formalism, this contour is this one. For us, which goes from essentially the important thing is that we have this periodicity of beta in this case. Okay, so if you go beta, so that this is this contour scene, polygraphic scene. And the point is that by taking functional derivative with respect to j, this is the generating functional for the correlation functions that you get evaluated at different Euclidean times. Okay, now
another
alternative is the real-time description, the real-time formalism. And so in this case, one way to understand that, and I'm going very quickly about this, just giving you a qualitative picture, is as Atsushi was mentioning. So you can think about that as actually deforming this contour. And, if you look at the details, you see that you have some restrictions, which I was mentioning, that the imaginary part must always be increasing in this way. But then, by considering this kind of deformation, there's a particular deformation that you can consider, which would correspond to this one that he drew for us. But notice that it would be very similar to what he was saying, that what I'm going to present is very similar, but not exactly the same. So you would see. And so you would have this this contour. This is a deformation again of the contour that you have that we had before, and the point is that you could interpret also the analytic continuation of the correlation function that you obtain in the Euclidean formalism to Lorentzian time in this way. And you have a correlation function and generating function for them along this contour. And the important point is that this part that you obtain here is just the usual, well, for those of you who are more or less familiar by now, you've heard a little bit about it, is the closed time path. Is the part of the integral that corresponds to the closed time path. This is what you need to calculate through expectation values or correlation functions rather than transition matrix elements, because then you are taking the same state, the correlation function of the expectation value, so you have to evolve that state, and then with the unitary evolution operator, I'm not sure if everyone is familiar, and similarly then this one. So these two pieces here will correspond to these two paths. Okay, but then you have to provide some initial state, and so this is the initial state, but in general it could also be a mixed state, so then you would have actually something like this, calculate correlation functions and so on from there. The point is that this part of the path integral is doing precisely that. So when you use, I'm going a little bit fussy because I want to spend a lot of time, but for those of you who are a little bit familiar with the closed-time path formalism, as we mentioned earlier this morning, so this gives you the real-time, the two unitary evolutions for real-time evolution, but you have to specify the initial state, and then you integrate with the configuration of the initial state. And the point is that by using this contour here, this piece of the contour is giving this particular type of initial state, which is the equilibrium, thermal equilibrium state for the full interacting field. This is important, not for the free theory, but for the full interacting field. So if you calculate this along this contour, it now has this form, that's what it's doing for you. It gives you this initial state for the closed-time path formalism, which is the thermal equilibrium state of the full interacting field. Okay, so now a couple of remarks about this. So as I mentioned, this is what you get naturally by analytic, by the formation of this contour, and so the correlation functions that you would get from the imaginary time formalism when analytically continued become these correlation functions in the closed time path. So immediately, naturally, you get already the closed time path ones, and with this initial state that I was mentioning. Okay, so now a couple of remarks that we see that are also important for discussion afterwards in the sitter. One is that because of closed time path, if you extend this contour like this, nothing happens as long as all the correlation functions that you are trying to calculate have their arguments in this part. So this part here, you can extend that, but these two things essentially cancel. This is just in terms of Euclidean, in terms of this contour and functional integrals, the fact that you would have, you know, the cancellation of this imaginary, this piece of the imaginary unitary evolution operators if you don't have an additional operator insertions in for those. Okay, so that's one, but that's one point. We'll see. That's important. As long as you're calculating things like that, in closed-time path, you could take all the way to infinity, but that part would not contribute. It would always shrink to that. In the sense that, well, we'll see in a moment, that it is sort of relevant for some of the inherent divergences that you encounter in certain calculations, for instance, in the sitter when we do in-out, because you have to integrate, as Sasha Polyakov sometimes discusses, that you have to integrate over the full, the sitter space time. But the fact that you can see in closed-time path correlation functions, at least that part coming from there, we don't have an infrared divergence because you have this kind of cancellation. That's a simple historical way of interpreting why in the closed-time path formalism you don't get these infrared divergences that you get otherwise when calculating these Feynman diagrams using in-out.
Wasn't he talking about the extension into the past?
Well, I'll say a few more things about that. But certainly, even if you just consider this half from a finite time to the infinite future, that's already leading to a problem in in-out.
Right, I know the infinite future thing, but I'm pretty sure he was talking
about
that.
Yeah, I'll say a few more things about that. I'll say something about that. That's another additional equilibrium. But for the moment, I wanted to remark this about the future. Okay, so in closed time path, we don't have that, and there's a simple way of understanding this. By the way, another thing that I should have mentioned, and I'm going a little bit quickly, is that just from this formulation for an arbitrary contour, you could just extract from here the usual Feynman rules to do perturbation theory and so on, and then what you would see is that all the vertices in your Feynman diagrams have to be integrated along this contour. So that's what you have to consider. Okay, so just just one final remark, and then I get to the sitter. So there was this point about the infinite divergence that he put, that is, if I integrate all the way to infinity in the sitter, but which is not the case because you have this cancellation when you consider the closed-end path. And then there's another point in this case, is that now you can consider changing the initial time. So let's say that you move the initial time to some later time here. At least for this simple case of flat space, that is not going to change things, because in this case, if you use really this description, this is the thermal equilibrium state for the full interacting theory. And so under evolution of the full Hamiltonian, this is stationary. Okay, so this stationarity then essentially means that it is not going to change. So if you look at the calculations, you will have some kind of cancellations, so that you actually have this property. So that essentially you can also extend this to the past, and the result is not going to change for your correlation functions.
It's because the state you are using is eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Eigenstate of the full interacting
well, Hamiltonian. Yeah, it's not an eigenstate because it's a density matrix, but yeah, it's stationary under the evolution of Hamiltonian, exactly. Okay, so this is for the simple simple considerations in thermal theory in flat space, but nevertheless, I think that it's a useful analogy to think about the situation for the sitter. So let me now get to that. So now the point is the form. So let's consider in the particular case. I'm going to discuss what this construction of the. I'm not going to explain it in great detail, but the kind of state that I will be interested in is this construction for the Hart of Hockey state. So for those of you who are very familiar with this Hart of Hockey construction, some static space time, and in this case you can consider two patches of the sitter to do that construction, which corresponds also to the Euclidean somehow. You say this, and then discuss also Euclidean correlation functions in the sitter. Okay, so. Okay, so if this is the whole thing is very analogous to what we had in this case of thermal field theory. So now, by the way, you could also consider the ground state, the wave functional for which is a pure state for the ground state by just taking this integral from minus infinity to Euclidean time to some time, and then you would produce the wave functional for a pure state for the ground state. Okay, so the analog of that for the Hart and Hawking state construction is actually to do the calculation of this Euclidean path integral which takes some value phi on the surface sigma by essentially considering so how should I put this? We are integrating over this whole hemisphere, and then we are specifying the boundary conditions here. Okay, the value phi, the field here. And then we are integrating over all possible values of the field here with this measure, with this boundary condition. Okay, so that defines for you the state in Schrödinger picture, functional, which would correspond to the Hartmann problem. And again, if you have some interacting theory, the idea is that you are using the full action theory, including the interaction theories. Okay, so now the point is the following. If I just try to do the closed time path construction in this case, well, it would be something like this. So you would have the real time evolution. You would have two branches. This is the analog of what we had here. Okay. And then you have to specify the initial state. So you have these two branches in Lorentzian, the simple spacetime. You have to take the trace and identify actually change the cooperation of the fields on these two final machine microsurfaces. Two things are identified, so glued together. And then you have to specify the initial state, which is just given by this construction, Hart of Hawking state, okay, using the action, the Euclidean action for the full interaction, and similarly for this one, which gives you the complex function. Okay. Okay, so then this is closed time path. And the important thing is that we are considering one the Hartman Hawking state for the full interacting theory, in analogy with what we had before.
So the identification at the top is the analog of the turning of the,
yes,
of the cosine path?
Exactly. It's said in this picture.
Right.
Okay. And
there's
this just
separate hemispheres? Or isn't there some
two separate hemispheres, okay. Yes, which would correspond to this and the complex conjugate of this.
Meaning?
Because remember that the meaning has to specify this. So I had written that cosine path effective action for you, and then including this initial state, I would have use the phi as a function of psi as a function of phi and psi star as a function of phi prime and integrate that. But maybe I can write it more detail if you want afterwards. But that's that part.
Well, in the upper case, you have similar picture, but instead of this hyperbolic, you just have planes glued.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, for thermal theory, these two things are connected when you have the thermal density matrix. For the ground state, it would go all the way to infinity, but consider this situation where it's compact and then the densities are like a few states. Okay, so as I said, the important thing that is that this is for the full interacting theory. Okay, that's one remark. But of course, if you want to consider the free theory, then it would just generate the Mann satisfaction. And that's why it's also called the Euclidean vacuum, one more. Okay, and so this would be, as I said, my satisfaction for the free theory. Now, the point is that similar to this, the fact that one can sort of think of the analytic continuation of the correlation functions from imaginary time to real time by considering this deformation of the contour, one can think of something analogous in this case. So, if you do some calculation on the sphere, so this is the same thing as we had before. Now you would have this generating functional, okay, and this could be again the sitter. It's just that this contour now corresponds to either this equation here, or in this case I'm considering now just here. Okay? And then you would have a generating functional. In particular, you can calculate, let's say, the correlation function, two-point function, for instance. And then you analytically continue to Lorentzian time for the arguments of this correlation function. Now the point is that just by analogy with the picture I had before, I mean, you can think about it. But that naturally gives you this. Some, well, it depends on which branches, but it will give you a correlation function in closed time path with these initial states. So this is the point that I'm not giving a mathematical proof, I'm just giving you some sort of pictures to give you a qualitative, some suggestive qualitative demonstration at this point. But this is what I'm trying to say, that if you do the calculation in the on the sphere for some correlation function, you can use when you have interactions, Feynman diagrams with integrating the vertices on the sphere for the moment. Now you can understand this analytic continuation of the correlation functions real time by complete analogy with what we had before with the deformation of the contour of integration. And so then you automatically get this combination of the correlation functions corresponds to closed time path correlation functions. That's one thing that you get automatically. And also you get automatically that the initial state, if you are doing this for the full interacting theory, is also this Hartman-Hawking state of the full interacting theory, which is the candidate for being a decided invariant state. But you would need then to see that this thing really works. So for instance, when you have situations where you expect to have maybe some sort of instability here, typically what you see is that you have some infrared divergence when you do, for instance, the calculation on the convenience. So that
is it appropriate to use global coordinates on this Lorentzian slide? Isn't it really a static patch,
yes,
two static patches we should be talking about?
Well, so it turns out that when you do the analytic continuation, it's true that you can do the analytic continuation in that parameter that with that metric that Tsuchiguchi was writing for us, and that would sort of give you the analytic continuation. For these two regions, but then you can extend that to these by analytic continuation. And in fact, for the sitter case, there's another way in which you can do, another way of thinking about that is that you can do the analytic continuation of the sphere not along this angle that he was considering here, but along another angle. And then, let's say, this suppose that you take this pole and then you take the angle, the neutral angle that is coming from this sphere, and then the analytic continuation of this It's immediately due to this one. So you can think of these two ways. It's an analytic combination, which is the one that cosmologists usually use in this context, quantum cosmology and so on. But that is essentially, equivalent to having used the one that actually...
But there is a problem of ordering these times on the sphere. If you order the times, you get in a wedge. I mean, this is known since...
What do you mean? Okay. So you, indeed you have here the usual...
When you do the Osterwalder-Schrader thing, I mean, going from the sphere to the real hyperboloid, since the paper of Nappi, Ekron, and the paper by Landau and Klein, but it's a geometrical abstraction. I mean, if you make any ordering of these points, in the end, you get all the configuration in a single wedge, I guess. You see what I mean? You cannot get a generic configuration.
What typically happens is that, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, but what typically happens is that when you do this analytic continuation, indeed, if you go outside this wedge and to go to this region, what you see is that you actually have some cuts.
The point is, you have endpoints on the sphere, you end with all the endpoints in a single wedge. In the static
well, patch. So what happens, I think, is that maybe you can explain in more detail, but you will have certain cuts, you will have to choose how you continue that contour, and that does correspond to the fact that you will have different choices, because you can have the time order for
yes, different choices, but always in a single wedge. Not always the same wedge, but always in a single wedge. See what I mean?
I don't think so, but I don't know if Kevin has something to say.
Yeah, that's not true. Your operator ordering issue is a good one. What is true is that you can do the computations on the sphere without using any coordinate system. You can write, because on the sphere it's a rotationally invariant state, you can write down the correlation function as a function only of the rotationally invariant distances between the points. And what both Don and myself and Stefan Hollands have shown is that those correlation functions are analytic in these invariant distances away from the cuts on the light cone. So if you want to continue to Lorentz signature, there is a unique analytic continuation which preserves maximal symmetry. So that will give the time-ordered correlation function. It is a very interesting question to ask if you can, in a slick way, get the Whiteman functions.
No, the time-ordered correlation function is unique.
So if you don't mind, because this is really not... if you don't mind, we can discuss it maybe at the end,
right.
And let me continue. So let me just say one more thing about this first point, and then I'll get to the Riemann correlators. So this was somehow the Euclidean continuation. I wanted to remark two things. Somehow I already mentioned that. But one is that precisely because of the same reason that we had before, you would have cancellation. You don't have infrared divergences coming from integrating over arbitrarily large times in the Desider manifold, because you have this cancellation between the two branches completely analogous to what you had before. So you don't have divergences. Of course, you might want to consider if you have an obstruction here, and then it would correspond in the real-time description maybe to have a non-trivial quick, but you certainly have this cancellation of infrared divergences.
But in case of stationary states, you don't have infrared divergences at all. You
well,
have
okay,
to care
so
about
what,
that.
When you do the calculation for in-out and you just use one copy of this, you do the calculation and the integrals for your Feynman diagrams and you get this kind of
in case if you have a stationary state, I don't see even a point using informally.
Right, but this is not the case here. So this does not correspond only to the static patch. If you were just in the static patch, then I would agree with you. But this is not just the static patch. So what I'm trying to say is that this is important because sometimes I think that when one discusses the analytic, if one tries to interpret the analytic continuation from the sphere to just this, half of this, then you have certain problems like these divergences and so on. But the point is that that's not what you get naturally. What you get naturally by analytic continuation from the sphere is this picture here, which is the closed-hand path.
Sorry.
Not only half of this.
But can you stress, for example, why all this doesn't work in case, for example, if you take any field theory and take a density matrix which is not stationary? All this doesn't work.
Well, so essentially the point is that the main thing is that you want to have this construction for the state.
So the only thing is reduced whether you have this kind of state or not.
When you can connect this by analytic continuation, on the one hand, this construction with the state, and then this analytic continuation, but yes.
I'd like to stress, you have to construct exact interaction.
It doesn't work in general, I agree. First of all, if you consider arbitrary initial state, this is not going to be true. But also you need to have these static patches so that we can do this.
For example, if you use Budge Davis in free field theory, and evolve it with interacting Hamiltonian, this doesn't work.
If you put, this is the other point I want to stress. So this cancellation about the divergences, because you naturally get Poulsen path from here, and the other point is that you automatically get, as initial state, the Hartle-Fonkin state for the interacting theory, not the free one. If you had the free one, I completely agree, then you would have no trivial evolution. But the point is that by analytically continuing from the sphere, it automatically does these two things for you in principle. One, it gives you Poulsen path correlation functions. The second, it provides an initial state, which is this Hartle-Fonkin state for the interacting theory. And that's the one that you hope the evolution to leave it the sitter invariant. If it were only for the free theory, and then you have interactions in the evolution, in the real-time evolution, that would not be the case.
One more question, which I don't know whether I should ask it right now, but...
So then don't ask it, because I'm really running out of time. So, let me now just say QP. I mean, I was discussing this because I thought it would be useful to think about this, but not, I don't want to spend the whole talk about with this. So let me just now connect a little bit with the real-time formulation, namely the inning. And by inning, somehow I mean post-time path, but with asymptotic initial conditions, and maybe I can say something about, what Richard was asking, but just a second. So this is again just the spatially flat coordinates or Poincaré patch. And so now the point is that we are switching gears. Forget about that for a second. And so now we are considering this sort of closed time path formalism or init, but now static from minus infinity and with this I epsilon prescription that corresponds to that slightly tilted, that weak rotation that Sushi was also mentioning, but not in the static patch, but in the conform in the spatially flat. So this is important. What I'm talking about now is, again, you would have cancellation of divergences coming from integrating over arbitrary latents in the future for the same reason. And so this is for this time, complex plane. So you would have this Anderson prescription. And now let me just also emphasize a couple of things. By writing the action for some interacting, the example of some interacting theory in this way. So think of these examples. So you have some scalar field, a couple of scalar fields. So here I should also add the appropriate, let's say, in four dimensions that you can do it also in general, so that they are conformal, just to make it the discussion simple for the moment. And then you would have some mass terms. And maybe you would say this some cubic term interaction, some quartic term interaction. And then these kind of terms, just to give you an example, which corresponds to a non-renormalizable interaction, which is sort of analogous to what would be the gravitational interaction.
Why do you repeat twice d phi squared?
The second term could be it, no.
This or what?
No, kinetic terms.
Ah, right. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so, and now what's usually done is that it's convenient in this context to just rescale the fields. You have to put them inside the derivative, so that's why it's sort of relevant. And so in the end, what you end up is with this action in flat space, in the spacetime. So I'm rescaling the fields in this way. And so you end up with this. So if I use this rescaling, then in the end, what I'll end up is with, if I rescale things in that way, I would just, these things would cancel. This would be the rescale fields. Similarly here, but then the curvature would be in flat space, so this is zero. And then these terms have this a squared. This has an a, and this has one over a. What I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to illustrate here, is the following point. is that depending on, well, first of all, of course, in this case, A goes to zero when theta goes to minus infinity. And so for the free theory, for instance, what this is giving you, when you use this, well, is that it's naturally giving you the adiabatic vacuum, this kind of prescription is giving you the adiabatic vacuum of the free theory. But, oh, sorry, the remark I want to make is that the adiabatic vacuum of the free theory in this context corresponds to the Banks-Davis vacuum of the free theory. So notice that, for instance, for the free theory with some mass term, this goes to zero, this term goes to zero when you go to minus infinity. And similarly for other superly normalizable interaction terms, not for this one, the marginal one, there you have to do something similar to what you have in flat space to get to that point, to select the ground state of the interacting theory, which would be using this I epsilon prescription, similar to what happened in flat space. And the other remark is that in this case, you have a positive power of eta, which would diverge when eta goes to minus infinity, but nevertheless, you have all these exponentials that come from the modes, which are well inside the horizon, and the I epsilon prescription, that exponential sort of still cancels the problem that you would have at minus infinity from this positive power of eta. So, okay, so summarizing, I'm sorry, now I have to rush a little bit about this, but for marginal, not for these, because these go to zero, but for certainly for marginal operators, the I epsilon prescription is playing this role of selecting the ground state of the, some adiabatic ground state of the interacting theory. Because now you are not in a static situation. It's not really selecting, it's not the same that you have in Minkowski, but nevertheless it selects the sort of adiabatic ground state of your interacting theory. And so I was just pointing out that when you have non-renormalizable interactions, it's a little bit worse, but it's still, well, we still think that it should.
Can you say what happens again? You lost me on that. What is it that causes that term to
change? This one?
Yeah.
So the idea is that when you actually start doing the calculation and go to minus infinity, even though you will have an eta here which becomes very large, when you look at your calculations, you will see that all these things will contribute, you will have oscillatory terms. And this I epsilon prescription that will appear in the time, that is the argument of your oscillatory terms, of your exponentials, will give exponentials that decay when you go to minus.
This is on shell.
But it's the same way it would work for this term, to select the ground state of the interacting theory. It's just that now you have this prefactor that seems to diverge, but you still have these exponentials that are going to.
Yeah, but this is on shell, right? If you integrate over all harmonics.
In what? I'm totally lost.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I realize that I really have to write.
Okay.
Otherwise,
go ahead.
What I was trying to say is that you do the calculations for the Feynman diagrams, and you look at, you can express them in terms of modes, and
yes.
The important point, and this is something that I do want to emphasize, is that this works when you work in specially flat coordinates. Because when you work in specially flat coordinates and you go to minus infinity, then all your modes, as you go to minus infinity, are well within the horizon. Then it's very similar. They are oscillating, it's very similar to what you have in flat space. The situation is very similar to what you have in flat space. But this does not work if you consider closed coordinates. So this is an important point I wanted to make. In especially flat, yes, because it's very similar to what you have in Minkowski. The only difference is that rather than strictly a ground state, you have this adiabatic ground state. But you have other features, like the fact that for superly normalizable, it's better, slightly better behave. But in closed coordinates, that's not the case. If you try to use this sort of I epsilon prescription or adiabatic thing for closed coordinates, it won't work because for closed coordinates, your modes are well outside the horizon as you go to the path. They are sort of constant almost or not oscillating depending on the mass. So that's why it does not work. This prescription is not is very different. It should not, it's not, in general, you don't expect it to work for closed coordinates. But for spatially flat, it does. So the point is that you have these two ways of calculating things. You have this in with this with prescription, this I epsilon prescription, and spatially flat coordinates. And that's what you expect to be able to compare, as Sushi was mentioning, to that calculation. But you cannot try to do this with closed coordinates. Then you would have a problem. If you want to work with closed coordinates, this is the way, in principle, I can think of it, is that way. Although, in practice, doing the calculation might be more complicated. Or you can try to do it as an analytic continuation from the Euclidean. That's the way I would do it if I want to do it in closed coordinates.
I ask, so this analytic continuation is in which variable?
There? In the time of the
which time? Time of a wedge or not?
You can do it in these two. That's what I was, that answer that I gave. You could do it for the west, but you could also do it for this time, which is the usual time of the global time, the global coordinates, the different parameter translations of the sphere. But let's discuss that at the end, if you don't mind. Okay, so now, yes.
Let me just wait. So how much do I have? 20?
So, 20? No, I have more like 8 minutes.
8?
Yeah. His clock is not working.
Okay. okay, so then just very quickly. It's useful to consider this. You're familiar with many of these things in the sitter. It's useful to consider this maximally symmetric bitensor that you get by taking derivatives of this quantity z or the related quantity, which would be the geodesic distance. And so these are invariant under isometries. And what's also interesting is that there's a theorem by Allen and Jacobson that guarantees that any maximal symmetric bitensor can always be expressed as a linear combination of tensor products of these. And okay, and then I was just mentioning that how to extend that to pairs of points which are not geodesically connected to a given point in the sitter. And so you can do it by analytic continuation, as they explained, but we gave something that we were not aware in the literature, which is a simple geometric interpretation by taking into account that even though when two points are not geodesically connected, the antipodal point is geodesically connected, and then you can interpret it very easily in geometrical terms what these things mean when the two points are not geodesically connected. And now I have to switch to the computer. So, and I'll start talking about the one-loop Riemann correlators. Have to go quickly. So just do perturbations around the sitter as a background. Perturbative quantum gravity, non-renormalizable, you have to interpret it, think of it as an effective field theory. There's also mean field approximation here, which might break down when you have large fluctuations. I wanted to say a few things about that, don't have time. Now we are going to consider n-matter fields, and then when you consider that, it's also useful to rescale your coupling constant, the Planck length, the square of, or the gravitational coupling constant in that way. When you do that, then you naturally have a large N expansion. And in particular, to leading order in this large N expansion, you have this equation for the background. The sitter is a solution of that. You could consider radiative correction, but I'm not going to go beyond that order here. And I'm going to talk about the closed-time path correlators for the metric perturbations in this context. And they correspond in this setting, in this large N expansion, to the 1 over N, the leading order in 1 over N. And so this is the sort of contribution that you would have. This includes the corrections from loops of matter, but notice that it does not include loops of gravitons. Those would correspond to contributions at higher order than 1 over N. In particular, by doing that, among other things, you have this simplification that you don't need to consider the five Popov cost don't play any role, only when you start considering loops of gravitons. Now, what we're going to calculate is these two-point functions for the metric perturbations to one loop is actually the Riemann. The object that we are going to consider is the Riemann. The reason for that is because the background quantity is proportional to this product of deltas, and so its leader derivative vanishes. That means that the linearly perturbed quantity is gauge invariant. And that is still true for the correlation function of the Riemann to leading order in 1 over n. Okay, so it's a gauge invariant thing. And we are going to express the results in terms of these maximally symmetric tensors, so that if one can give the result in terms of those, then it's immediately the sitter invariant manifest. And here I was mentioning why we use the Riemann. Okay, so it does characterize the local geometry fully. It's compatible with the sitter invariant, so if you want to analyze that, it's better than other gauge invariant quantities. And then here I wanted to mention something that I can leave it for the discussion, a little bit along the lines of what, in connection with what Don was saying, the comparison between using the Riemann or some other gauge invariant quantities, let's say for the gravitons. Okay, so you can decompose the Riemann in two parts, the contribution from the Ricci and the Riemann, or equivalently to the Ricci and the Einstein, and you can see that the Ricci part, or the Einstein tensor, is essentially given at this order, at leading order, and lowest order in the Planck length square, so the Planck length fourth, by the correlation function of the stress tensor. And that would be the amputated diagram here. Then you can also, then the other contributions are correlations for the vial. There you do have to perform the integral over the vertices. And you already have a contribution at tree level, but we are interested in the which has already been computed before. We are interested in the one loop correction there. Which would be, and similarly, you have this cross correlation term. Okay, so let me tell you very quickly the results for the Ricci correlator, which is essentially, as we saw, equivalent to the stress tensor. So we studied the correlator for the stress tensor in the Bartley-Davis mapping. And I'm giving the results here for the minimal coupling case. So you can express the result in terms of maximally symmetric bitensors. It would be 10 of them, but those coefficients, which are functions of Z, are not independent. You only have two which are independent, but you have to calculate those for any. This is true for any theory in general. It just, the reduction comes from conservation and the symmetries that you have. And then for a specific theory, you do the calculation and fix these two functions. And then you get this result, which is manifestly the Sitter invariant. We got the result for free scalar field, but you can also do it with other free fields. For arbitrary dimensions, it can be arbitrary mass and couplings. I'm mentioning the results here for minimal coupling, and it can also very easily extend it to another maximally symmetric space, which is anti-de-Sitter also in arbitrary dimensions. Now, the point is that so rather than giving you the full result, I'm actually highlighting here some interesting properties, in particular the long-distance behavior of these tensorial prefactors, which are functions of Z. So always in minimal coupling for arbitrary dimensions, it's interesting that for the massless case, this function, well, there are some which decay faster, but the ones that have a fall-off at large distances, which corresponds to Z much smaller than minus 1, that region over there, how does it decay at large distances, at large values of Z in absolute volume? Well, so for the massless case, it decays like falls out like 1 over z squared. But the interesting thing is that for the massive case, but very light, you have something like this. So if it means much smaller than h. So this exponent here, this is the dimension, can be very, very small. So it means that it decays very slowly with distance. So you can have long-range correlations. So in a sense, as you can see, at the first sight, maybe it might be surprising to some of you, because it turns out that you have a stronger infrared effect for the massive, light, but massive case as compared to the massless case. But that's actually something that has a simple way of, one can simply understand that. And so this point that I was mentioning here, the simple way to understand that is, well, forget about some of these details, it's that this mass term from the stress tensor is really coming from there. When you are in the massless case, this term is not there, and everything else just gives you that result I was mentioning. But when you are in the massive case, very light, but massive, this term is there. This m squared is very small. But then you see that it's really coming from the phi squared, which has this very, for the massive case, for the strictly massless case, this quantity would diverge, but this term, phi squared, but this term is not there. For the massive case in the sitter, this does not diverge. It decays very slowly with the distance, but it does, this discontinuity that you have in the massless limit, you can see that because it's proportional to 1 over m squared, essentially the amplitude. But these things, essentially, when you calculate these two-point functions, they cancel, this m squared and this 1 over m squared. So that's why you have this, for very small masses, you have these things which decay very slowly, but the massless case, okay. So for the vial correlator, and then I'll just get to the conclusion. So it's interesting because not being amputated and having the two vertices integrals is more sensitive to the initial state corrections that you get due to the interaction, that some of the things I was mentioning here, that you don't see with the Riemann at the order that we are working. So this is something that we are calculating, and the way we are doing the calculation is using the INIM in spatially flat sections. Now, I had some comment here, perhaps someone is interested about the fact that you don't have dependence on the mu scale for these correlation functions. And you can compare that also with the slow roll calculations, at least for the gravitational response.
Scale with a much regular session.
Yes. That's another dimension. So this is some calculation that we are... Yes?
How did you avoid that?
I'll tell you afterwards. For some of the correlation functions, not for all of them, for some of them, for the anti-commutator, for instance, or the space like separated, I can tell you at the end.
But
and,
you did have to get the right flux space limit, right?
Yeah, so I can. So I was mentioning here our results, and the only thing that we can, that's the end. is that, well, implications for the gravitational wave power spectrum of this sort of thing, if you go to Fourier space, of course, these are not the usual variables, that the gauge invariant variables that you consider, but just to give you an idea of what's going to happen. So the Ricci correlator has no contribution, remember, to three level. The first one is at one loop. The VAR does have contributions at three levels, so this would look like the power spectrum for the VAR. And then corrections at one loop. And the thing is that for the massless case, just what we found in configuration space, you have this kind of behavior. For very light fields but not vanishing masses, you have this kind of term, the fact that it decays much more slowly, that you have long-range correlation. So you have this red-tilted correction to the spectrum. And by the way, the Sitter invariance, when you evaluate things at the same time, we do it, the calculation for different times. But in this case, I'm particularizing to equal times, and then the Sitter invariance amounts to of the result to the fact that we have this pre-factor, and then everything else should be a function of the physical momentum of k over at. So thank you very much for your
attention. We have time for questions.
Okay, comment and then some questions. First off, a comment. My senior graduate student's thesis problem is to calculate the graviton self-energy for exactly the massless minimally coupled scalar of the limit order, and she's already got the answer and had it some time and is using it to calculate the force of gravity, the correction to the force of gravity, and the correction to the mode functions. And I'm just stating that publicly so there won't be any misunderstanding that she may have. That you might think that she stole that result from your shape. It already exists. I can show it to you if you want to see
it. So do you find that it's the Sitter invariant?
Oh, sure, of course. That was already obvious from the fact that there's two derivatives in the stress tensor. We knew that before we ever calculated it, but that had to be true. So that's the first question. Second question, just like you, we get, of course, that there are two undetermined functions in that thing, functions of, we used y rather than z, it's a difference here. R of y is 1 minus z over 4 for you. But same difference. Did you determine what those two functions are?
Yes.
So there's a spin 2 part and a spin 0 part.
You mean for the Ricci, for instance?
Yeah, for Ricci, that should be the thing that's the graviton self-energy, essentially, up to some time factor.
Yes, the amplitude part, you mean.
Right.
Yes.
The self-energy.
Okay. Yes, so...
won't be I 2.
So let me understand, the calculation you did is for the full with the external legs also, or only the amputated one?
Just the amputated
one. That one is already, so it's published.
I just wanted to state that, we didn't know that, and she didn't take that result from you, it already exists, she's got it, she has
So you were saying...
did you use it to do anything?
Yeah, so I didn't give the results here, but essentially the kind of functions that you get for these coefficients, the two independent ones, are this product of the hypergeometric functions that we saw in the morning. Because this object here, well, it's derivative of those. I can show you the paper after.
Be a power series in 1 over 1 minus z.
I can show you afterwards. Essentially, the point is that when you calculate this correlation function, it's a product of two Weismann functions, but with derivatives acting on them. So the functions that you will get will be...
that's before you act the derivatives.
Yes.
So after you act it,
right.
And put it all
together. Oh, because you mean that you have the result for the minimally coupled case. For the massless case.
It wouldn't matter. Any of them are going to be...
Right. So what I'm saying is that I was mentioning the result that you get in general for arbitrary masses. But then, of course, when you consider a specific case, particular cases like the massless case, minimally coupled, then everything is much simpler. So I can show you afterwards.
Yes, I'd like to see them. Second, did you use it to do anything with, like, what her thesis problem is to use that in the quantum-corrected effective field equations to see what happens to graviton mode functions and also to see what happens to the force of gravity? Did you check over those?
Not really. So actually our main focus now on this part, well, there are some other things, but it's actually trying to using these things to calculate the Weyl correlator, which is a much harder calculation because you have to do the integrals over the vertices. So that's what we are focusing on now.
Any of these things are right. I mean, one might, for example, ask, one thing that the math types sometimes say to the inflation types is, you don't need inflation. We could have just started with an initial state which had all these super horizon correlators and everything. That's kind of a purblind point of view, right? I mean, inflation is the causal way to get the superhorizon correlators and everything. Same thing there, right? I mean, you've started with a state which would enforce all this complicated structure that those of us otherwise motivated might have believed happened by starting from something else and then seeing it build up over time.
But
how do we know that any of this is right? What tells us that, that that's the right way to look at it? Is there some principle at work there?
Well, so, okay, so several comments, but maybe we can discuss that also at the end. So this is a convenient way of thinking about it mathematically, but then the other discussion is, suppose that you just want to use specially flat section and start with some patch which is slightly larger than the horizon, which I guess is what you have in mind. So then the question is, what is the natural thing to consider the some sort of state that does take into account somehow the corrections from the interaction or just the product of the free states or the situation?
Well, some idea of what's the right way, what's a natural way to start the universe.
But in any case, I agree with you. You need a theory for initial conditions. So this is something you would get, for example, from quantum cosmology, or you have some principles, either you postulate or you need to some theory that naturally provides initial conditions. The only somehow point here is that it seems more natural to consider, the, even when you consider some patch or whatever, the state for the interacting theory rather than the product of the free.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think we're out of time, so let's move on to our next speaker.